Well, welcome, my friends, to The Catholic Reason, a radio show produced by St. Michael Catholic Radio, where we think through various claims made by the Catholic Church concerning issues of faith, morality, and culture, and provide reasons behind those claims. My name is Carlo Broussard. I'm a staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers at Catholic.com and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team at the Diocese of Tulsa in Eastern Oklahoma. Thank you so much for joining me today. I think you'll appreciate what we think through today, picking up from where we left off in last week's episode. Last week, we looked at three alternative theories to the Christian claim that Jesus bodily rose from the dead: the conspiracy theory, the hallucination theory, and the vision theory. We introduced the apparent death theory, but we weren't able to get to it due to time. And recall, we gave reasons why the conspiracy theory fails as an alternative explanation of the circumstantial details surrounding the alleged resurrection of Jesus. And we gave reasons why we think the hallucination theory and the vision theory do not work either. And remember, we lumped those two together because all the answers or the critiques that we gave apply both to the hallucination theory and the vision theory. In today's episode, we're going to pick up again with the apparent death theory and also look at other alternative explanations to the Christian explanation of Jesus' resurrection as well. So the theories that we're going to look at in today's episode are the grave robbery theory, the wrong tomb theory, and the resurrection of the spirit theory. And these three theories should get us through today's episode. We'll see how it goes. If we have time, we might throw in one extra theory or alternative explanation as a bonus, but I doubt that we'll have time to get to it. Now, the Catholic claim here is that these theories, the grave robbery theory, the wrong tomb theory, and the resurrection of the spirit theory, fail also as adequate explanations of the circumstantial details surrounding Jesus' death and alleged resurrection. And I say alleged, given the dialectic here, because we're having to make our case as Christians for the historical reliability of Jesus' resurrection. And one way to do that is to present our hypothesis of the circumstantial details and show that the alternative explanations fail. And once we do that, then we're able to show that the Christian explanation stands strong and is the most reasonable explanation, and therefore we can reasonably conclude that Jesus' resurrection is a historical fact. So again, if we can make good on this claim that the alternative theories fail within the Christian hypothesis that Jesus rose from the dead bodily and in glory, remains the best explanation. And so we would have reasonable certitude that he rose from the dead. So let's go ahead and start with the apparent death theory. This is also known as the swoon theory. And the theory is raising the question, how can we be certain that Jesus actually died on the cross? That he was crucified seems to be historically certain, and a skeptic might be willing to grant that. But there are modern cases of people who are pronounced dead and then a few hours later start breathing again, right? So maybe that's what happened to Jesus. Maybe he apparently died. It was thought that he was dead. And then upon being put in the tomb, he eventually came to consciousness and was able to get out of the tomb and present himself to the apostles. And from that, the apostles thereby concluded that Jesus was risen from the dead. The origins of this theory seem to be found in the British biblical scholar Hugh Schoenfield in his book, The Passover Plot, which, not its original origins, but it was made popular. That's what I was intending to say. It was made popular by the British biblical scholar Hugh Schoenfield in The Passover Plot. It was a 1965 book that Schoenfield published. The roots of the theory itself can go back to Carl Friedrich Barth in the 18th century, mid to late 18th century. He was a German polemicist and theologian. Now, there are basically four critiques that we can give to the apparent death theory. The first critique is that it contradicts gospel details that ensure the death of Jesus. First of all, it's having to assume that the mountain of evidence for the death of Jesus Christ is unhistorical. And that's a tall obstacle to overcome, because there is a substantial amount of historical evidence to affirm the historical reliability that Jesus died. And so this apparent death theory, right out the gate, is going to have to reject that mountain of evidence. And that's a tall order. So it's unreasonable even on that score. But we can go with this and just say that it contradicts gospel details that ensure the death of Jesus. So what are some of these details? Well, I'm going to share two of them with you here. And the first of which is just his crucifixion that was preceded by his scourging. So once we take that into account, that's a gospel detail that doesn't seem to fit well with this apparent death hypothesis. And I would like to direct your attention to an article entitled On the Physical Death of Jesus in the March 1986 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. A team of three, including a pathologist from the Mayo Clinic, after giving a detailed explanation what would have happened during a scourging, the pain involved with the crucifixion, and death by asphyxiation, the article concludes, quote, "Accordingly, interpretations based on the assumption that Jesus did not die on the cross appear to be at odds with modern medical knowledge." And so this team in this particular journal article is concluding, listen, given the historical evidence of crucifixion and scourging and all of that, it's unreasonable to say that Jesus would not have died. Now, a skeptic might counter here by appealing to Flavius Josephus and his work, the life of, in his autobiography, The Life of Flavius Josephus. Josephus reports a survivor of a crucifixion. So he writes this, "And when I was sent by Titus Caesar with Cerealis and 1,000 horsemen to a certain village called Thecoa, in order to know whether it were a place fit for a camp, as I came back, I saw many captives crucified, and remembered three of them as my former acquaintance." He goes on, "I was very sorry at this and went with tears in my eyes to Titus and told him of them. So he immediately commanded them to be taken down and to have the greatest care taken of them in order for their recovery. Yet two of them died under the physician's hands," he reports, "while the third recovered." And so the argument is, hey, look, Josephus says that there was three friends of his who were crucified. One of them survived. And so just because Jesus was crucified, that wouldn't entail that he automatically died. So maybe the apparent death hypothesis has some traction here based upon the historical evidence that we have from Flavius Josephus, a first century Jewish historian. So in response, first of all, I'd say this. This individual that Josephus is referring to didn't have a brutal beating and scourging prior to his crucifixion. Notice Josephus says, "I saw many captives crucified." It's unlikely the Roman soldiers would have given the special attention of scourging to these, quote unquote, many captives like they did to Jesus. As such, this particular individual's crucifixion doesn't really compare to what Jesus went through. And so, yeah, it's possible that that individual was crucified and was taken down and thereby survived, but that doesn't necessarily mean Jesus would have survived his crucifixion, because his crucifixion was preceded by torture and scourging, which, according to that team of three in their journal, in their article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, concluding that given the beating and the scourging prior to the crucifixion, there's no way Jesus would have survived that. And then secondly, in response to this skeptic's counter appealing to Josephus, it's possible for that individual to survive the crucifixion given that he was taken down from the cross, and which would have allowed for him to begin breathing normally. Whereas when you're stuck on the cross like Jesus, you can't breathe normally, and so, as some will say, he died by asphyxiation. And so there's just a disanalogous parallel here between Josephus' friend, who was on the cross, taken down and survived, and Jesus' crucifixion, preceded by the scourging. So that's the first gospel detail that contradicts the apparent death hypothesis, namely Jesus' crucifixion and the intense scourging preceding it. Now, there's another gospel detail that conflicts with the apparent death hypothesis, and that is John's report of the spear going into the side of Christ there in John 19, chapter 19, verse 35. And there are five reasons to think that this report in John's gospel is historically reliable. If we can show with these five reasons that John's report of the spear going through the side of Christ is historically reliable, well, then we would have a solid historical gospel detail that would give us reason to think Jesus, in fact, did die, which conflicts and militates against the apparent death hypothesis. And the first reason is that the alternative explanation is that John's lying, right? So if we don't accept this detail from John, that our Lord's side was pierced, then we're going to have to say John was lying. And that's unreasonable. Why? Because John specifically says in John 19:35, he was an eyewitness. He says, "He who saw it has borne witness. His testimony is true." So he's vouching for its veracity. And he knows that he tells you the truth that you also may believe. So if the gospel detail is not historical about Jesus' side being pierced, then John is lying. But that doesn't seem reasonable to affirm that John is lying given his character. First of which, the alternative explanation that John was lying is unreasonable. Given the character of John, the author of the Gospel of John, it's unreasonable to think that he would have been lying about this stuff. Second reason why this gospel detail, John's detail of the spear entering into Christ's side, is historically reliable is that it coheres with Roman practice. So the Roman author Quintilian, he lived from AD 35 to 95. Quintilian reports this procedure being performed on crucifixion victims in one of his works, Declarationes Maiores, in 6:9. He writes this: "As for those who die on the cross, the executioner doesn't forbid the burying of those who have been pierced." So there you have a Roman author, non-Christian source, corroborating the detail in John's gospel about Christ's side being pierced. Reason number three for this detail in John's gospel being historically reliable: John's report about the breaking of the legs of the thieves is consistent with Roman practice there in John 19:33. And of course, they didn't break Jesus' legs because he was already dead. And so the idea here is that John's right in touch with first century Roman practices, and that provides credibility for him in reporting to us accurately what's going on and what he saw. There's actually archaeological evidence for this. New Testament scholar Craig Blomberg, in his book, The Historical Reliability of John's Gospel, writes this: "It's of interest that the bones of a man crucified in this period discovered in the area north of Jerusalem had been broken. One leg was simply fractured, the other was smashed to pieces." So the legs of the men crucified with Christ are broken, he goes on to say in verse 32, but when soldiers come to Jesus, they find that he is already dead in verse 33, as Mark 15:44 confirms. So we have archaeological evidence corroborating John's report that the Roman soldiers broke the legs of the thieves in order to bring about their death more quickly. Whereas when they came to Jesus, they didn't break his legs because he was already dead. And so given that archaeological corroboration of John's report, that gives yet more credibility to John's report to conclude that, yeah, when he says that a spear pierced the side of Christ, he's accurately reporting that. And that gives us good historical reason to think that Jesus actually died. Reason number four for the historical reliability of John's account of the spear piercing Christ's side: John's report about blood and water flowing out is consistent with medical experts. John records that detail in verses 34 through 35 of John 19. So again, appealing to New Testament scholar Craig Blomberg in his book, The Historical Reliability of John's Gospel, Blomberg writes the following, quote, commentators and physicians alike have debated the medical significance of the outflow of water and blood. For a survey of the options, he says, see Beasley Murray, 1987, and that's a source that he cites. He goes on, one of the best appears in the study by the doctor-turned-theologian John Wilkinson, 1975, who concludes that the blood is from Jesus' heart, the water from the surrounding pericardial sac, and that this combination is exactly what one should expect from a victim who had expired only minutes earlier. He goes on, what first-century readers would have recognized was John's emphasis on the complete and genuine death of Jesus. So John's report about blood and water flowing out of Jesus' side, that's consistent with medical experts. So yet another corroborated detail, right, or a historically reliable detail that gives reason to think that John's report about the spear piercing Christ's side is historically reliable. And finally, the fifth reason why we can trust John, side piercing is consistent with Mark's report that the centurion affirmed for Pilate that Jesus was dead. There in Mark 15, 44 through 46. So you have a detail in John, independent of Mark, that corroborates what Mark tells us about the affirmation of Jesus' death. So that's a consistency there. There is a coherence between John's detail and Mark's report that's not on face value in any way meant to be directly connected, but yet you have details that are consistent with each other. And so that's yet another reason to trust what John tells us when he says a spear pierced our Lord's side. Given that a spear pierced our Lord's side, we can thereby conclude that we have gospel details, historically reliable details that affirm that Jesus actually died. And of course, that contradicts the apparent death theory, which says that possibly Jesus didn't die. Okay? So how else might we respond to the apparent death theory? Well, a third critique, or I guess you could say a second critique here, is that the theory lacks plausibility. And it lacks plausibility precisely because it doesn't explain how the appearances convinced the doubting apostles that Jesus was risen. So if you think about it, half dead beaten Jesus, right, somehow gets out of the tomb, probably barely can walk and present himself to the apostles. It's highly unlikely, very implausible that such a half-dead, beaten Jesus is going to convince these apostles that all of a sudden, oh my gosh, he is gloriously risen from the dead. Hallelujah, right? It doesn't make sense that that sort of the way Jesus would have been present to them would lead them to that conclusion. And this line of reasoning actually comes from a liberal German theologian, David Strauss. In his book, A New Life of Jesus, he writes this, quote, it's impossible that a being who had been stolen half dead out of the sepulcher, who crept about weak and ill, wanting medical treatment, who required bandaging from the scourging and the flesh ripped off of his body, strengthening and indulgence, and who still at last yielded to his sufferings, could have given to the disciples the impression that he was a conqueror over death and the grave, the prince of life, an impression which lay at the bottom of their future ministry. Such a resuscitation could only have weakened the impression which he had made upon them in life and in death. At the most, could only have given it an elegiac voice, but could by no possibility have changed their sorrow into enthusiasm, have elevated their reverence into worship. And that's on page 412 of his book, A New Life of Jesus. And I think Strauss makes a great argument there. It is highly improbable that the half-dead, beaten Jesus, weak and ill, looking for medical treatment, would have presented himself to the apostles. And the apostles all of a sudden went from sorrow to enthusiasm, being distraught and defeated to thinking they had victory and that Jesus was Lord over death. Just doesn't make sense. There is a disproportion there between what this apparent death theory entails and the effects that it had on the apostles. A third critique of the apparent death theory is that it lacks explanatory power. And it lacks explanatory power because it doesn't adequately explain the empty tomb. In order to explain the empty tomb, in order for the apparent death theory to work, the apparent death theory basically is only accounting for the appearances, the postmortem appearances of Jesus, the alleged resurrected appearances. But it fails to account for the empty tomb, or at least fails to adequately account, because it would have to postulate the conspiracy theory or a conspiracy theory concerning the placement of the guards at the tomb. Okay? So you got a half dead, beaten Jesus coming out of the tomb. Well, remember, the Gospels tell us that guards were placed there. So the only way to explain the fact that the half-dead, beaten Jesus got out of the tomb and presented himself to the apostles is if the guards at the tomb was a made-up, fabricated detail. Because if the guards were, in fact, there, well, then, of course, you wouldn't have the half-dead, beaten Jesus getting out of the tomb and going to the apostles. So the apparent death theory lacks explanatory power, and finally, it lacks explanatory scope because it doesn't account for Paul's conversion, who believed Jesus was raised in glory, according to Philippians 3:21. How do you account for that based on this apparent death theory? You can't. And so therefore, the apparent death theory lacks explanatory scope. So for these four reasons, the apparent death theory fails. Now, next, I'd like to start talking about the grave robbery theory. We're going to look at three more for the rest of the episode. Hopefully, we'll get to all of them. The second here is the grave robbery theory. So the idea here is that somebody stole the body and left the tomb empty. So the disciples went, they saw the empty tomb, and then inferred from that that Jesus rose from the dead. And that's basically how the theory goes. Now, in response, we can give five responses or critiques of this theory that can be categorized into two different categories. The first of which is the first category being implausibility. So think about this. It's unlikely anyone besides the guards, Joseph of Arimathea and the women would have known. It's unlikely anyone besides the guards, Joseph of Arimathea and the women would have known where the tomb was. So most would have thought that the body would have just been thrown where the bodies of criminals are normally dumped, okay? So the idea of Jesus's body being stolen and the grave robbery theory doesn't fit with the fact that you only have a select few people of knowing where Jesus's body would be. And so that the idea of a grave robbery theory doesn't quite make sense. Secondly, grave robbers don't rob bodies. They rob linens. And so that historical detail doesn't seem to fit with the grave robbery theory. And then thirdly, the theory has to add the conspiracy theory concerning the guards at the tomb. Like the apparent death theory, you have to add an extra theory to account for certain details. In this case, the guards at the tomb. So the grave robbery theory, in order for that to work, you're going to have to say, well, the guards at the tomb was a made-up detail too. It was a made-up detail, and that would account for how robbers could come and take the body from the tomb. So for these three reasons, it's implausible that Jesus' body would have been stolen and the tomb being left empty. Now, the second category of responses here is that the grave robbery theory lacks explanatory power. And it does so, first of all, because it doesn't adequately explain the early Christian belief that Jesus rose from the dead. So like the apparent death theory of a half-dead, beaten Jesus showing himself to the apostles, that doesn't explain how the apostles would come to believe that Jesus rose from the dead bodily and in glory, right? In glorious resurrection. Similarly, the grave robber theory doesn't explain the early Christian belief that Jesus even rose from the dead, period. So first of all, the theory states that the early Christians inferred from the empty tomb that Jesus rose, but it's unlikely that they would have inferred this. In fact, Luke's report of the women finding the tomb tells us they were perplexed. So we even have evidence from Luke that they did not infer the resurrection from the empty tomb. They were actually perplexed. They didn't come to that conclusion Jesus rose from the dead right away. And moreover, rather than the early Christians inferring that Jesus rose, it's more likely they would have thought either that someone stole the body, because that's kind of common stuff, or that Jesus' body was assumed into heaven, maybe like Enoch or Elijah. So that's something that would have been in their mind, that maybe they would have thought that. The tomb is empty because maybe Jesus' body, he was favored by God, he was taken up into heaven, like the Old Testament Enoch and Elijah, or somebody just stole the body. But of course, that seems to stretch the boundaries of reason because, who would have known where Jesus' body was? You only had a few people knowing that, the guards, Joseph of Arimathea, and the women. Now, this theory also lacks explanatory power because the theory doesn't account for the conversion of Paul, very much like the apparent death theory. It's unlikely that an empty tomb alone would have given Paul reason to believe that Jesus rose from the dead and convert to Christianity. He was in no position to even desire that Jesus rose from the dead. So the grave robbery theory accounts for the empty tomb, but it's failing to account for the other details. It doesn't account for the conversion of Paul. It's not accounting for the early Christian belief that Jesus rose. It's not accounting for the guards at the tomb. That conflicts with it. And it's just implausible because grave robbers don't rob bodies. They rob linens. And you only had a few people knowing where the tomb was in the first place. So for those reasons, we can conclude that the grave robbery theory fails as an adequate explanation of the circumstantial details reported to us by the gospel surrounding the alleged resurrection of Jesus. With the grave robbery theory complete now, let's turn to the wrong tomb theory. And so the idea here is that Jesus' empty tomb was based on a simple mistake. The women simply got lost, so it's argued, on their way to the tomb that Sunday morning and happened to meet a caretaker at an unoccupied tomb in the garden that they mistakenly thought was Jesus' tomb. And he said something, maybe the caretaker said something like, "You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. He's not here." And the women were so unnerved, so the story goes, they fled. And after the disciples had experienced visions of Jesus alive, so therein you have to include the vision theory here, right? The women's story developed into the account of their discovery of Jesus' empty tomb. So what should we make of the wrong tomb theory? Well, there are several critiques here, and like with regard to the grave robbery theory, these critiques can be categorized into certain categories. So first of all, you have this theory lacks explanatory power, and it lacks explanatory power for a couple of reasons. First of all, the women witnessed the burial. Luke tells us that in Luke 23:55. So to suggest that the women got lost or they mistakenly thought the empty tomb was Jesus' tomb, that doesn't comport or cohere with what Luke tells us that the women witnessed the burial. They would have known where the tomb was. Secondly, this theory requires us to reject the historicity of Joseph of Arimathea, which is unreasonable. And we don't have time to go into all the lines of evidence for the historicity of Joseph of Arimathea and what the Gospels tell us about him and it being his tomb. But here's a quote from New Testament scholar Raymond Brown in his book, The Virginal Conception and Bodily Resurrection of Jesus, published in 1973. He says this: "A few adventurous scholars have suggested that the very idea that the body of Jesus could not be found sprang from the impossibility of correctly identifying his body in such a common burial ground. However, an almost insuperable obstacle to such theorizing is raised by the person of Joseph of Arimathea, who appears in all four Gospels, it's virtually certain that he was not a figment of Christian imagination, that he was remembered precisely because he had a prominent role in the burial of Jesus, and thus that there was someone who knew exactly where Jesus had been buried. So the wrong tomb theory lacks explanatory power because the women actually witnessed the burial. They knew where the tomb was. And this theory requires us to reject the historicity of Joseph of Arimathea, which is unreasonable. Now, the second critique of the wrong tomb theory is that it lacks explanatory scope. And it does so because, first of all, the theory doesn't explain the belief that Jesus rose. Christians wouldn't have inferred resurrection from an empty tomb. They would have probably just thought grave robbery, right? And you can check out John chapter 20, verse 13. The women were perplexed. They didn't automatically conclude about the resurrection. And then this theory lacks explanatory scope because the theory doesn't account, again, for Paul's conversion. Paul wouldn't have converted simply because of an empty tomb, which is all the wrong tomb theory can explain. You're going to need other things to complement the wrong tomb theory in order to account for all of these other details. Now, a third critique of the wrong tomb theory is that there are further deficiencies. So consider these. I'll list two here. The theory requires an added theory, namely the vision theory, which suffers from its own deficiencies, as we looked at in last week's episode. Because if you're going to account for the empty tomb by way of the wrong tomb theory, you're still left with the Christians saying they saw Jesus. So how do you account for that? Well, either you're going to have to say they hallucinated, which has its problems, as we talked about in last week's episode, or you're going to have to say these were visions of Jesus, which has its problems, the same problems for the hallucination theory that we talked about in last week's episode. And so that's a deficiency of the wrong tomb theory. And then finally, there's no evidence that Joseph and those that helped him exposed the Christian blunder. There's no evidence ever in the early Christian testimony in history that the Christians got the wrong tomb, okay? Neither Joseph of Arimathea comes forward and says that, nor anybody else or anybody who helped him. And Dr. William Lane Craig puts the argument this way in his book, Did Jesus Really Rise? Since Joseph, as well as other servants helping him, knew what they had done with the corpse, the theory is at a loss to explain why they didn't correct the disciples' blunder once they began to proclaim that Jesus had been raised from the dead. Unless, that is, one resorts to contrived conjectures to save the day, for example, that Joseph and his servants suddenly died after moving the body, as some skeptics might want to say. Now, the last theory that we're going to look at today is the resurrection of the spirit theory. The idea here is that the early Christian message that Jesus rose from the dead was intended only to mean that the spirit of Jesus, not his body, was awakened from the grave and lives on in heaven. The physical nature of Jesus' resurrection in the Gospels, so it's argued, is a later development from the non-physical tradition that we find in Paul, say. So in response, I want to give four general responses to the theory, and then if time permits, we'll look at that key text from 1 Corinthians 15 where Paul talks about the spiritual body, and some will appeal to that as evidence that Paul is intending to say that Jesus did not rise bodily, but just rose in the sense of his spirit lives on in heaven. So with regard to the general responses, the first is that this theory doesn't fit with the Christians' delayed preaching of the resurrection. And New Testament scholar N.T. Wright makes this argument in his book, Jesus, the Final Days. He writes this, when the Christians said that Jesus was raised from the dead on the third day, they must have meant this, namely that he was raised bodily. Otherwise, he points out, why was he not raised from the dead immediately upon his death itself? Why wait for 3 days? So the idea here is that the early Christians say that Jesus only rose after 3 days doesn't fit with this idea of Jesus' spirit living on in the afterlife, and that's what the Christians meant by the resurrection of Jesus. Because if that's all they meant, well, then they should have been saying Jesus rose immediately after his death. But they didn't. They said he rose only 3 days later. A second general response is that the Jews knew nothing of the idea that resurrection was something that happened only to the spirit and not to the body. This idea of calling the spirit living on in the afterlife as a resurrection is entirely foreign to first century Judaism. So the question becomes, why would Paul, a good Jew, use the term resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15:3 when he says he was raised within a Jewish context where all understood it to be something bodily? That there is no nuanced explanation of what Paul meant by resurrection proves that Paul and the early Christians meant what the Jews meant by resurrection, a bodily resurrection. Again, N.T. Wright argues as follows in his chapter, the chapter that he contributed to the book Passionate Conviction. He says this, "I have often heard it said, sometimes by people who should know better, that Jesus died and was resurrected to heaven. But that's precisely not what the early Christians said. Raised from the dead, yes. Exalted to heaven, yes. But resurrection never meant going to heaven when you die. And it certainly did not mean that when people used it to talk about Jesus. So the idea that Jesus rose from the dead in the sense of his spirit lives on in heaven is totally foreign to first century Judaism and their theological milieu and their belief concerning resurrection. For them, resurrection was bodily. And so for Paul to start preaching the resurrection of Jesus within that theological milieu, within that theological context, leads us to the only conclusion that Paul was preaching a bodily resurrection, not a spirit lives on in the afterlife kind of resurrection. Now, the third general response is that Paul parallels our bodily resurrection at the end of time with Jesus' resurrection. And so here's the evidence. In 1 Corinthians 15:49, Paul says, "Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven." So this is the whole context is about our bodily resurrection at the end of time. And Paul is saying, we're going to image Jesus in his quote-unquote resurrection. Romans 8:11 is another example. "If the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised Christ Jesus from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies, also through his spirit who dwells in you." And so in light of these two passages and Paul's sharing, like giving us his theology of our bodily resurrection being modeled off of Jesus' resurrection, we can infer from that that Jesus rose bodily. So here's the argument in a logical form, let's say, okay? Premise one, if our resurrection is bodily, this would be a modus ponens, by the way, for my logical friends out there. If our resurrection is bodily, then Christ's resurrection was bodily, right? Because Paul is saying our bodily resurrection is going to be modeled off of Christ's. So if ours is bodily, well, then Christ has got to be bodily. Premise two, our resurrection is bodily. That's what Paul says. And so therefore, Christ's resurrection was bodily as well, at least within Paul's mind. So Paul has no idea of this idea of a resurrection entailing or being the spirit simply living on, the soul living on in the afterlife. A fourth general response here is that the theory makes the debate about the empty tomb, the guards, the angels, etc., superfluous. And again, I'm taking this from N.T. Wright in the chapter he contributed to the book entitled Passionate Conviction. He writes this, "The debate itself, that some say Jesus' body was stolen and others say it wasn't, bears witness to my more fundamental point that in the first century, resurrection wasn't about exaltation, spiritual presence, a sense of forgiveness or divinization. It was about bodies and tombs. If someone would have been able to say, oh, don't you understand? When I say resurrection, all I mean is that Jesus is in heaven and he's my Lord and that I have a new sense of God's love and forgiveness. The dangerous debate about tombs, guards, angels, and bodies could have been abandoned with a sigh of relief all around." But the whole point is that all of that stuff was involved. Tombs, guards, angels, bodies. That's what makes up the whole gospel accounts of the alleged resurrection of Jesus Christ. If all they meant by resurrection was Jesus' soul lives on in heaven, then all of that stuff is superfluous. There would be no need to even waste the ink on the scroll in order to tell us about all that stuff. That they include all those details leads us to only one conclusion. They thought Jesus rose bodily. So this resurrection of the spirit theory simply fails on these four accounts, these four general responses. The theory doesn't fit with the Christians' delayed preaching of the resurrection. Jews knew nothing of the idea that resurrection was something that happened only to the spirit and not to the body. Paul parallels our bodily resurrection with Jesus' resurrection, and the theory makes the debate about the empty tomb, the guards, and the angels superfluous. Okay, well, what about the claim that Paul seems to suggest in his writings that Jesus' resurrection was spiritual and not bodily? Well, there are several passages that the skeptics will appeal to, but one in particular is 1 Corinthians 15:44, where Paul says, our bodies are sown a physical body, it's raised a spiritual body. If there is a physical body, there is also a spiritual body. And so Paul envisions our future bodies as spiritual bodies, and given that they are to image the resurrection of Jesus and his resurrected body, the skeptic concludes, or the argument concludes, that Jesus' resurrection was not a physical resurrection. He merely appeared to them in a vision, and the resurrection was his spirit living on. Now, in response, spiritual doesn't necessarily mean immaterial or non-physical. In 1 Corinthians 2:15, Paul says the spiritual man judges all things, but is himself to be judged by no one. Does Paul mean that you have a man here who's only soul, only spirit, and not corporeal? Of course not. He's referring to something else. So spiritual doesn't necessarily mean immaterial or non-physical. Secondly, Paul is contrasting in 1 Corinthians 15, mortal body with immortal body. So the phrase physical body, which in Greek is soma psychikon, is better translated as natural body, because psychikon elsewhere in scripture refers to this worldly. 1 Corinthians 2:14, Paul refers to the unspiritual man. James 3:15 refers to wisdom that is unspiritual. Jude 19 uses the same Greek word for worldly people. And Paul's point is that our future bodies will not be like this worldly or natural body. It's not going to be mortal and subject to decay. It's not going to be corruptible and dying. It's going to be incorruptible and immortal. And the only way it's going to do that is because it's not only going to be animated by our souls, which is natural to it, but also by the Spirit of God. And in virtue of the Spirit of God that dwells in us, as Paul argues in Romans 8, 9 through 11, our mortal bodies will live forever. So that's what Paul means by spiritual body in 1 Corinthians 15:44. It is our bodies animated by the Spirit of God, which gives it the power of being incorruptible and immortal like our souls. So spiritual body does not mean that it is a pure spirit. It simply means the fleshly physical body animated by the Spirit of God. And so there is no grounds for this resurrection of the spirit theory to get off the ground. Well, my friends, unfortunately, that does it for this week's episode of The Catholic Reason. I am out of time. The apparent death theory, the grave robbery theory, the wrong tomb theory, and the resurrection of the spirit theory all fail as alternative explanations to the Christian hypothesis of Jesus' glorious bodily resurrection. Thanks for listening to The Catholic Reason, a production of St. Michael Catholic Radio. I hope and pray that you invite others to join me again next week as we continue looking at Catholic claims and the reasons behind them. Tell a friend. I'll talk to you then. God bless you.